teaching the law of Moses this morning. And we will probably be in the law of Moses for a while. I want to start just as an introductory matter. Just to talk about kind of where we are all at on the law of Moses. It's always helpful for us to, you know, before we enter into a topic, kind of sit down and evaluate, what ideas we're already bringing in as we enter into the study. So that way, you know, hopefully the study can illuminate things that we have not been thinking of, or can correct errors that we have fallen into in our thinking. So I want us to start just by asking a really basic question. What is the law of Moses? The Ten Commandments, yeah, it's a little bigger than that.
Yeah.
A little bigger than the Ten Commandments. It includes the Ten Commandments.
It's all the first five books. It really is the whole the Old Testament. If you want to be technical about it, it includes any law that was given by Moses to the Israelites that they had to follow. It was given to God from God to Moses.
Okay, Wayne has actually just given us three different answers in that answer there. And I want to, well, and that's why I asked the question. I knew somebody would, I knew we would eventually get all of those three answers. I just didn't guess it would all be in one shot from one person. So here's how we often think of the law. We often think of it as the first five books. What we sometimes call the Pentateuch, which is, it just means five. The Penta in Pentateuch means five. So referring to the first five books, sometimes called the Torah. Well, that's the thing. Sometimes we use the word Torah to refer to the first five books. So the word Torah itself in Hebrew just means law or commandment or teaching or instruction. And that was another one of the answers that Wayne just gave, that it was specifically the laws given to Israel. So the actual commandments themselves, you know, what we most famously know is it boiled down to the Ten Commandments, right? And then Wayne gave us a further answer. It's the whole Old Testament. Now, that one's a little less common, because generally, the Bible does not refer to the whole Old Testament altogether as the law, although sometimes it does. The law can be kind of a catch-all category. Usually, whenever Scripture is talking about the Hebrew Scriptures, the Old Testament, it's divided up into three sections. Do y'all know what those three sections are? The law is one of them, and the prophets, and what we sometimes call poetry, or what they call the writings. All right. So we'll just kind of put this in parenthesis here, that the Old Testament is usually split up into the law, the prophets, and the writings. And the writings is basically just a catch-all category. It's anything that's not the law or the prophets. So, like all of the history that we get outside of the law of Moses. Yeah, Wayne?
When Jesus was talking about the law, he mentioned the law and the prophets.
Yes.
But he did not mention the writings. Which, you know, sometimes people will separate from that and say that's something else that doesn't apply to the law.
Right. Well, and that's the thing, is we also have to recognize, and part of why this is a valid response, is that the entire Old Testament is built around the law. All right? The prophets and the writings, these are both responses to the law. They're built on the law. If you want to get the prophets and the writings, if you want to get, and by writings, yeah, we're talking about the wisdom literature, we're talking about the Psalms, we're talking about the histories, basically all these things that don't fit into the first five books or the 14 minor prophets, plus the major prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, anything that doesn't fit into that mold, we say is the writings. And if you want to understand any of that stuff, you've got to understand the law. It's all bound together. Now, sometimes, though, this can lead us into some confusion because of how loosely we use the law of Moses as a phrase. So, let me just give you a good example. Sometimes whenever we're talking about the place of the law in Christian life, we will point out what is said in the New Testament about the law. Sometimes, and we do some paraphrasing, and we do some Jungle Gym work to accomplish this. But I hear it often enough. We say something to the effect of, you know, Jesus took the law, and what did he do with it? Nailed it to the cross. You see, that answer came almost immediately. This is something that's common to us. What does that mean? That Jesus took the law and nailed it to the cross. Now that's when this question gets really important, because what exactly did Jesus nail to the cross? Was it just the laws which Moses gave to Israel? Or was it the whole Pentateuch? Or was it the whole Old Testament? And you can meet Christians of every stripe, by the way. Y'all might remember, it was a big fad back when I was a kid, in the 90s, and I think in the early 2000s as well. There was a big fad of standalone New Testaments. That might have just been a thing in my part of the country where I was growing up. But just about everybody I knew had a standalone New Testament. Because that was kind of the prevailing view among some of the brethren that I grew up around, was that whenever we're talking about Jesus nailing the law to the cross, basically that's signaling that the New Testament is the important part. And the Old Testament has been made largely irrelevant by the work of Jesus. Let me just put it to you. Do you think that idea is supported by Scripture generally? That the Old Testament is irrelevant? Now, you know, what exactly, like what place it has in our lives as Christians is a big, big point of discussion. Right? It's not the sort of thing that you could boil down in 10 minutes or even the 35 minutes that we've got left. But depending on how you answer this question, you're gonna treat the Old Testament in different ways. Excuse me. So, we need to be able to understand that it is used in all of these senses. It is used to refer specifically to the law codes given to Israel at points. But now here's the thing. There's a difference between this and the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible. How much of those first five books consist of actual law codes? In other words, if you're reading through the first five books of the Bible, how long does it take you to reach actual laws, like the thou shalt and thou shalt nots of the law of Moses? Well, you get a commandment given to Adam. And you do get some additional commandments in the creation account. Yeah, be fruitful and multiply. There's work, tend the garden, and there's don't eat the fruit. Yeah.
That doesn't come to us, that comes to, you know, marriage is everyone.
Right.
That's the whole thing, but that's not given to Israel.
And that's the thing. You've got some specific commandments given to Adam and Eve that fit their particular context. But like the laws that we tend to think about as the laws given to Israel, like say starting with the Ten Commandments, how much of the law of Moses do you have to read through before you actually get to the law of Moses? Well, you read through all of Genesis, and you read through the first 19 chapters of Exodus. And what's going on for those, we're talking nearly close to 70 chapters. You know, over 60 chapters. What's going on for over 60 chapters in the Law of Moses? Well, what we've got is mostly narrative. Mostly stories. And that can confuse us a little bit because when we talk about law, we expect it to be law, rules. This is what you do, this is what you don't do. If you do this, then this is going to happen to you. And as we read through the Law of Moses, we get a lot of that, but we get even more narrative. All right? So all of the books, you know, contain some sort of law, but they also contain lots and lots of narrative. And in fact, some of them are more narrative than they are law. Leviticus is the big exception. It's mostly law. Wayne? Yes, that is something that is carried forward.
So that's chapter 12.
Yeah, so we're at least a little earlier then. Yeah. Yeah, now the commandments for keeping the Passover as a regular feast come later. But yes, yeah, that's a good catch. So, we do get some laws for Israel a little bit earlier than that. Still, the bulk of the Law of Moses is not law. So what do we do with that? One thing that we have to remember is that the Law of Moses fits within a particular context. All right, the Law of Moses is trying to accomplish a few specific things and is written in some specific ways. Let me put the question this way. In modern law, I don't know if y'all have ever read any sort of like modern legal opinions or anything. Not exactly exciting reading. But if you got a lawyer writing up a brief to submit to a judge, so he's giving his opinion on some legal question. You know, there's a case coming before the judge, and this lawyer's giving his legal opinion. The lawyer is going to cite a few things. He's going to cite the laws, right? So the specific rules that we have put in place that tell us that this is the way things should work. You are allowed to do this. You're not allowed to do that. Here are the penalties for breaking this law. But that's not all that a lawyer includes in a brief that he writes. You generally also get what we call case law. Right, or case studies. So in other words, how has this law applied in practice? How have other judges looked at this law and put it into play? Now, we separate those things out in modern law. Right, if you were to go, dig up a big book of like Florida statutes, it's all gonna be laws. Right? But you also, if you want to know how those laws work, you've got to look at case studies. All right, so how have courts in the past applied this law in different situations? In ancient law, and we've got to put the Law of Moses in that context, the Law of Moses is an ancient Near Eastern law code. So in ancient law, particularly in ancient Near Eastern laws, case studies were often mixed in with the actual laws themselves. And sometimes this would actually give you the history of how the law developed. Like, let's go ahead and get a good example of that. Go to Numbers chapter 27. All right, Numbers chapter 27. And this is going to touch on some inheritance questions that we have talked about in other contexts. So a big chunk of the law has already been given by this point. Then drew near the daughters of Zelophehad, the son of Hepher, son of Gilead, son of Machir, son of Manasseh, from the clans of Manasseh, the son of Joseph. The names of his daughters were Mahla, Noah, Hoglah, Milcah, and Tirzah. And they stood before Moses and before Eleazar the priest, and before the chiefs and all the congregation, at the entrance of the tent of meeting, saying, "Our father died in the wilderness. He was not among the company of those who gathered themselves together against the Lord in the company of Korah, but died for his own sin, and he had no sons." All right, now first off, before we go any further, what's the problem? Zelophehad is dead, and he has no sons. So what problem does that create? Yeah, what do you do with the inheritance? Where does it go? What happens to Zelophehad? Why should the name of our father be taken away from his clan because he had no son? Give to us a possession among our father's brothers. All right, so the daughters are asking to inherit the property, and furthermore, to be able to keep that property in their father's name in perpetuity. All right, because normally, all right, so let's say that they inherit the property, and then they get married. Whose property does it become? It goes to the husband's clan. Not just to the husband, but to his clan. All right, so in other words, we're not just concerned about individual property ownership. We're concerned with what family does this land belong to. And one of the basic principles in Hebrew land ownership is that land is not supposed to change hands, at least in terms of family. It's supposed to stay in each family perpetually. That's why it's called an inheritance. Whenever they go in to take possession of the land and they divvy it up, that divvying is supposed to stay permanent. Right? So, if you've had a plot of land in your family, you should, in theory, be able to trace it all the way back to the conquest. Excuse me. So the problem here is that Zelophehad is going to lose his property to some other clan. So Moses brought their case before the Lord. And the Lord said to Moses, "The daughters of Zelophehad are right. You shall give them possession of an inheritance among their father's brothers and transfer the inheritance of their father to them. And you shall speak to the people of Israel, saying, 'If a man dies and has no son, then you shall transfer his inheritance to his daughter. And if he has no daughter, then you shall give his inheritance to his brothers. And if he has no brothers, then you shall give his inheritance to his father's brothers. And if his father has no brothers, then you shall give his inheritance to the nearest kinsman of his clan, and he shall possess it. And it shall be for the people of Israel a statute and rule, as the Lord commanded Moses.'" All right, so this question comes up, and out of this question comes specific laws and specific applications of the law. And so here God ends up laying out a kind of a succession list, right? And so what we actually learn here is that under the law of Moses, actually women do inherit property. Now, whenever we said earlier that women typically didn't inherit property, that's in a lot of cases, that's generally true in the ancient world. In a lot of cases, women were cut out from property inheritance. Not so for Israel. The standard in Israel was that if there were no sons, then the inheritance goes to the daughters. All right, now this isn't the last that we hear of Zelophehad's daughters, by the way. And that's the thing with laws, too, is that, you come up with a solution to a problem, and it becomes a law, and Is that usually the end of it? Well, no, you kind of put it into practice, you see how it works, and then what do you always discover? New problems, right? Problems never cease. Go to Numbers chapter 36. Numbers chapter 36. The heads of the fathers' houses of the clan of the people of Gilead, the son of Machir, the son of Manasseh, from the clans of the people of Joseph, came near and spoke before Moses and before the chiefs, the heads of the fathers' houses of the people of Israel. They said, "The Lord commanded my Lord to give the land for inheritance by lot to the people of Israel. And my Lord was commanded by the Lord to give the inheritance of Zelophehad, our brother, to his daughters. But," and this is the problem we were talking about earlier, "if they are married to any of the sons of the other tribes of the people of Israel, then their inheritance will be taken from the inheritance of our fathers and added to the inheritance of the tribe into which they marry. So it will be taken away from the lot of our inheritance. And when the jubilee of the people of Israel comes, then their inheritance will be added to the inheritance of the tribe into which they marry. And their inheritance will be taken from the inheritance of the tribe of our fathers." And Moses commanded the people of Israel, according to the word of the Lord, saying, "The tribe of the people of Joseph is right. This is what the Lord commands concerning the daughters of Zelophehad. Let them marry whom they think best, only they shall marry within the clan of the tribe of their father. The inheritance of the people of Israel shall not be transferred from one tribe to another. For every one of the people of Israel shall hold on to the inheritance of the tribe of his fathers. And every daughter who possesses an inheritance in any tribe of the people of Israel shall be wife to one of the clan of the tribe of her father, so that every one of the people of Israel may possess the inheritance of his fathers. So no inheritance shall be transferred from one tribe to another, for each of the tribes of the people of Israel shall hold on to its own inheritance." The daughters of Zelophehad did as the Lord commanded Moses. For Mahlah, Tirzah, Hoglah, Milcah, and Noah, the daughters of Zelophehad, were married to the sons of their father's brothers. They were married into the clans of the people of Manasseh, the son of Joseph, and their inheritance remained in the tribe of their father's clan. These are the commandments and the rules that the Lord commanded through Moses to the people of Israel in the plains of Moab by the Jordan at Jericho. All right, so you see how that works. Not only are we getting the laws, we're getting a background for how the laws came to be, and we're getting some specific application of the laws. How do you put all of this stuff into practice? Excuse me, because law can be kind of confusing otherwise. So the narrative, all of these narrative bits fit into a couple of basic functions. The narratives either give us some case law, specific applications of the law, or they tend to give us origins of the law. And this can be a pretty big category. But one of the most prominent places where we see this is really, really early on. Go back to Genesis 1. In fact, I'm sorry, Genesis chapter 2. All right, so God has just finished creating everything, and in Genesis chapter 2, verse 1, we're told this: "Thus the heavens and the earth were finished, and all the host of them. And on the seventh day God finished his work that he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work that he had done. So God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it God rested from all his work that he had done in creation." All right, so obviously, what law do we just have explained to us there? The Sabbath laws. Why do we rest on the Sabbath? And by the way, the question would come up in that way, right? It's not that You got to think what things were like in the ancient world. It's not that some, you know, little Hebrew boy would be sitting down reading through Genesis, and he would come across this passage, and he would say, "Oh, because of this, I need to rest on the seventh day." It would play out the other way around. That you would have, you know, little Hebrew kids growing up, and like all kids, you know, they pay attention to what their parents are doing, and they start asking questions, right? Why, it's like our kids today, you know, why do we go to church on Sundays? You know, why do we sing hymns? Why do we take the Lord's Supper? Yeah, that sort of thing. Every kid asks these kinds of questions. And then you go back and explain, well, this is why we do this. But why do we keep the Sabbath? Right? Why don't we do any work on the Sabbath day? Well, you know, little Jimmy or, you know, whatever your little Hebrew kid would be named. Jimmy, I don't know. This is why we keep the Sabbath holy, because God created everything in 6 days and He rested on the seventh day. So we do our work in 6 days and we rest on the seventh day. And that basic paradigm, that basic idea explains a lot of the narratives in Genesis. Well, not just in Genesis, but I mean in the whole law, in the whole first five books. These narratives explain where everything is coming from. Where are the laws coming from? Right? Why did God command for certain things to work certain ways? Because these narratives also tell us who Israel is. And we've got to remember that. That the law of Moses, you know, the law of Moses is important for us to study today. But who is the law of Moses for? It's for Israel. And why did Israel need the law? Because they're a nation, and nations need laws. And what do laws do? What laws do is they're part of the glue of your common culture. Right? They're a statement of values for your culture. Right? This is what we as a people believe. And some of these things we believe so strongly that if you don't act this way, we're going to penalize you for it. Right? You know, there are some things that all cultures share in common, like the prohibition against murder. It's not something that's unique to any one culture. But there are some things that, you know, that make different cultures unique. What makes Israel unique? That's a really fundamental question. It's answered in the law of Moses. Well, what makes Israel unique? I mean, let me just throw that out there. Y'all could probably give a decent answer to this without having done the study first. What makes Israel special and different from all of the other nations around her? God chose her. That's the basic answer. They're the chosen people. And what is the story of the Torah? What is the story of the Pentateuch? It's the story of how God chose Israel. And that's what we see playing out. We see it playing out through the creation. We see it playing out through it becomes really, really clear once God starts interacting with Abraham. This is a story of God choosing His people. And the story of that choice unfolds all the way through the genealogy of Abraham, all of Abraham's descendants. This is explaining where Israel comes from and who they are. Right? Because we also have to remember the context in which Israel is receiving the law. Right? We said the law is for Israel. When did Israel get the law? At what point in their history? I mean, what were they doing whenever they received the law? Yeah, they had just come out from Egypt. So we're going to see a lot of things in Genesis, by the way, explaining where Egypt comes from. And in fact, the story of Genesis is the story of how did we end up in Egypt in the first place? That's how Genesis ends, essentially, is how did we end up in Egypt to begin with? All right, Wayne?
It's interesting, maybe go back to a little part of what you said about the origins.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting to me, there are laws like the Sabbath.
Yeah.
That was enacted, you know, back in the early day, okay, at the end of when God created.
Yeah.
That's something that happened to the whole entire earth, not just only Israel.
Yeah.
But marriage was passed on as a law to everyone, but Sabbath wasn't passed on to just one country. That's kind of interesting how God kind of picked and chose. This law applies to everybody. This other law doesn't apply to just one person or one nation.
Yeah.
It's kind of interesting how that worked out that way.
Mm-hmm.
And the reasons why, and that has something to do with the argument.
Yeah. Maybe a useful way to think of it is that there are some creation principles that pretty much all cultures have picked up on over the course of human history, marriage being one of them. I don't even want to say that most cultures have seen it and practiced it in the same way. Because over history in different cultures, you've got a lot of different marriage practices. But we see it especially with rest. Most cultures have picked up some version of the Sabbath, not specifically the Sabbath, right? You know, on Shabbat you are supposed to, well, I mean, we know specifically when it is, right? It's from sundown to sundown, right? It is the seventh day of the week. And there are specific restrictions for what you can and cannot do on the Sabbath. Now that is the way that God passed down the principle of rest to Israel. But other cultures have a principle of rest, right? Like if you go to South America, right, and you're out doing stuff during the day, you're not going to accomplish a whole lot of, say, like shopping or stuff in the early afternoon, right? Why not? What's going on? Siesta. All right, and that's just a quick example to, you know, grab off the top of my head. Most cultures have a principle of rest that, again, over the course of time, like they've taken this creation principle and worked it out in different ways. What Israel has that the other nations don't have is they have God holding them by the hand and guiding them through the applications. Right. This is the way that you work it out. This is the way that we do this, that, and the other thing. And this is who we are as a people. All right. Consider, for example, let's just go to Genesis 1:1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. Now, this holds a lot of significance to an ancient Hebrew, because ancient Israel was not the only ancient culture that had a creation account. Practically all ancient cultures had some sort of creation account. And the cultures that Israel rubbed elbows with the most, ancient Semitic cultures, had a creation account that ran in some ways very similar to this. That basically, in the beginning, everything was chaos. And the way that the gods made the universe, the way they made the world, was you've got this chaos, this sea, and you have this sea monster who is an enemy of the gods. And one of the gods slays the sea monster, and its carcass turns into the world. All right, which, you know, we think is, oh, you know, isn't that cute, those pagans and their silly superstitions. But this, that was what was, you know, that was the competitive thing on the in the marketplace of ideas, right? As Israel is coming out of Egypt and going to settle in the promised land, what is it that all of their neighbors believe? They believe some version of that. That in the beginning everything was chaos, and the only reason that we have order and form and function is that the gods came in and took an active hand and slew the sea monster. Just, by the way, you know, part of why they're all terrified of sailing. They slew the sea monster, and the carcass of this monster turned into the world as we know it and gave us all life. And part of what the law of Moses does, it's subversive. It says, no, that actually wasn't Marduk that did that. It wasn't Baal that did that. It was actually the God of Israel who did that. Because, you know, sometimes we don't pick this up from the first couple of verses of Genesis. When we read in verse 2 that the earth was without form and void, that's the chaos. Darkness was over the face of the deep. That's the chaos. The Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. Now, we don't have, you know, Genesis never tells us that God slew a sea monster and the sea monster's body turned into the earth. Right? But what we have is God conquering this chaos merely through His Word. Right? God doesn't have to go out, you know, like Marduk and fight some epic battle to destroy this sea monster. All God has to do is say something. He just speaks, and the chaos is gone. The darkness is gone. And in its place is what He wants. And one of the ways we know this is a response to pagan thinking about creation is the sea monster had a name, right? In the ancient myths, there are a few names that are used. One of the most prominent ones is Yam. That's how you'd pronounce it, not yam, like the vegetable, the root. Yam. Yam is this, you know, is the ancient sea beast. Do you know what the Hebrew word for waters is? It's basically that. That whenever God is hovering over the face of the waters, and this is recognizable to ancient cultures. This is recognizable to Israel, who had heard these legends. This is recognizable to any of their neighbors who believed these legends. And you've got the God of Israel hovering over the waters, and He is about to dispel the chaos and do away with it. And so it's Israel's God who does it. It's not somebody else's God. And then over the course of history, God is working with Israel specifically, choosing Israel, building them up in specific ways, and then drawing them out so that He can make a nation out of them and give them His laws. That's where all of these stories fit in. Okay, so we got about 5 minutes left. Let's finish with this question. What do we expect whenever we turn to the law? As we're reading through the law of Moses, what do we think the law is supposed to accomplish? Because, and I ask this for this reason, is the law of Moses a religious law or is it a civic law? It's both. It is both. And that can trip us up sometimes. Whenever we read through the law of Moses, we're going to read some things that may scandalize us a little bit, and may shock us a little bit. And you know, atheists in particular make a lot of hay out of the law of Moses. Like, oh, can you believe this really rotten, awful principle in the supposedly perfect word of God where, you know, and they'll always point out the laws that, you know, a rape victim has to marry her rapist. Right? That one is always top of the list for examples of why the law of Moses is just horrible and immoral, and who on earth would worship a God like this? It's because we have to remember that the law of Moses is not just a religious law code. It is a civic law code that is meant to govern a physical nation of people. Let me throw out this question. Is the law of Moses intended to make Israel perfect? No. We're told specifically that it cannot do that. But Wayne, go ahead.
You just put up there about the, you just read, you know, the person Genesis. Law, it's there, it's all inclusive, okay? Law, what law does is bring order out of chaos.
Mm-hmm.
It puts order, it puts things in order. Rather than, you know, keeping it in chaos. And that's basically what law does. Generics.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, that applies to anything that is out of order.
Mm-hmm.
Civic, religious, or otherwise.
Yeah.
It applies to everything. Law, no matter what, you know, generically speaking.
Yeah, keeping things, yeah, functioning and orderly. Yeah. Yeah, and that's correct. But the law, just here in our last couple of minutes, the law is not, but let's start from this point, the law cannot make people perfect. The Hebrew writer tells us that explicitly, because if the law of Moses could make anyone perfect, then what did not have to happen? Jesus did not have to die. He didn't even have to show up on the scene. The incarnation didn't have to happen, let alone the crucifixion, if the law of Moses were capable of making anyone perfect. And so sometimes we come to the law with this expectation that it has to be completely perfect in the absolute religious sense. That, in other words, God is not just giving Israel solutions to their problems, but He is giving them always the only and best solution. Like, best not just for them, but best for everybody in all time. Now, you know, we admit that that's not the case. In certain circumstances, right? Animal sacrifice, is that the best for everybody through all time? Obviously no. That's the whole argument of the book of Hebrews, is that animal sacrifice is surpassed. Well, first off, it's basically useless, the Hebrew writer argues. It was basically just a show. The only effective and true sacrifice was the sacrifice of the Son of God. All right, and we don't have any qualms about saying, yeah, in that regard, the law of Moses was meant to be basically made obsolete and superseded by a higher and better principle. And sometimes we get into the law and we get hung up on specific laws and we say, oh no, this is it. This is the eternal principle that was intended for the regulation of all mankind through all of history. Because God wouldn't give us an imperfect law. Right? And we're kind of catching ourselves in some bad thinking. It's like asking if God can, it's like asking if God can create a boulder that is too heavy for Himself to lift. Right? And you walk yourself into this paradox. Well, if He couldn't create the boulder, then He's not all-powerful. But if He could create the boulder, then He's not all-powerful. My head's gonna fall off my shoulders and melt into a puddle. It was a stupid question, is what it was. It's not that you have discovered some paradox that precludes the existence of God. The same thing goes with the law. Alright, so, we're gonna start by focusing on the narrative sections. So we're gonna start in Genesis, and Lord willing, pick that up on Thursday. Thank you so much for your attention and your comments this morning.